Okay, so I'm going to give you half of a Dharma talk, and then Suze is going to give the other half.
But we don't know what each
other. I have no idea what she's going to say. So basically, I thought I would give you just a little bit of my own experience with this topic. And before I was involved with Buddhism, I was involved with other spiritual traditions, primarily yoga and Sufism. And I also have read a lot from other spiritual teachers, from other paths. And everybody talked about the self, maybe the little self versus the higher self, or the ego, or something. But everybody agreed on one thing, even though there were different definitions and different approaches. Every tradition agreed that it's a problem, okay? So if you want to be liberated or enlightened, basically it has to go. Okay, so years ago when I was living in Quebec and my friends and I were spending a lot of time at a yoga ashram north of Montreal, well, we were talking about how do we deal with this? Because, you know, they say it has to go, but how? Right? So my friend had this idea. He said, well, if I don't use the words I, me, and mine, bingo, right? So he spent one whole day basically tying himself in knots, trying not to say those three words. And he was saying, this person is going to the store, and this person is going to have lunch, and this person doesn't like that. And we were just laughing at him by this point. And finally, he started laughing, too, and he realized it's not the words. It's not the words. Okay. So when my impression was that enlightenment will come in this one big flash of illumination, right? It's kind of like St. Paul on the road to Damascus or something. But I never could figure out how to make that happen. And sometimes in a very deep meditation, I would have these hints of something that seemed like universal consciousness or something, and I would think, maybe this is it, I'm enlightened. And then I'd come out of the meditation, and I'd go and I'd have an argument with my friend or something, and I thought, well, okay, maybe not. So some examples of how this has been presented to me in the past. First of all, in Sufism, there is this concept, an experience, I guess you'd call it, called fana. And I've discovered actually recently that different Sufi orders define it differently and everything. But in the Sufi order that I have been part of, fana means literally the annihilation of the self and union with Allah. And to the Sufi mystics, Allah is not so much the name of the one God as it is the name of the one being. In other words, it's everything. So you have this union with everything, which reminded me a little bit of Thich Nhat Hanh and interbeing and no separate self, right? Everything is connected. Okay, so you have this experience of fana, but then there's something that follows it called bakha. That is coming back into the world and coming back into yourself because you can't function otherwise, right? And hence we have the term the navigational self or the navigational self so that you can function. But you have this constant awareness of this other experience that you've had. So that was one teaching that I had. Then we had, a few years ago, we studied the Zen teachings, the ox herding pictures, right? Some of you participated in that. And they're all on the website if you haven't seen them. But that's basically this teaching that's told in this story with these 10 pictures of the ox herder who's chasing the ox who has escaped. And this represents the search for liberation. So the ninth picture is called Return to the Origin, Back to the Source. So there it is. That's that complete union again, that, you know, letting go of the self, everything. But the tenth picture is entering the marketplace with extended hands. You come back. You come back. But now you have a different sense of it, and you're no longer attached to the self because you understand the nature of it. Okay, so that was great. But in my experience, this has not seemed to be coming as one big flash of illumination. It's a lot more gradual. And that's what everybody I know. I mean, I'm willing to say some people get enlightened just like that, but not me. So when I first heard the conception of non-self, I found it very confusing because, you know, I have the sense of inhabiting this body, of experiencing the world through these sense doors. And I kept thinking non-self would mean that would somehow go away. And I just couldn't even imagine what that might feel like. But then recently, I was listening to a Dharma talk by Kate Munding, who is one of the guiding teachers at Spirit Rock. And she said, the Buddha didn't teach vacancy. He taught non-clinging. I said, oh, maybe there's a different way to approach this. So I started thinking about all the roles that I have played in this long life, and it's a long life now, the identities I've assumed, the opinions I've held, and to what extent have I identified with these roles, you know, with these opinions. You know, I started life, well, like everybody, as a baby, right? But specifically as a daughter. And for many, many years, I was a daughter. And then my parents died. Am I still a daughter? I don't know. You know, when I was almost four, I became a sister, a big sister. I'm still a sister, but I don't think of myself as a big sister anymore. My sister and I are peers. Those 4 years don't mean anything now, you know. When I was around five, I think, and I started reading, I started playing with taking on different names and different identities, and I wanted to be called by the name of whatever book I was reading. And the first books that I read was this series called the Honey Bunch series for very young children. Well, I had to be Honey Bunch, and I'm telling my parents that they have to call me that name, and I wouldn't answer if they didn't. And my poor parents are like coming to the door to say, Honey Bunch, come in to dinner. And that lasted a few, you know, until I finished those books, and then it was a different one. And I don't know how long I did that, but, oh, probably a few months, and then it just kind of fell away. But then, when I was in my 30s, because Judith is the name on my birth certificate, but my parents called me Judy when I was a kid, and I never liked it, and I never felt like me, right? So when I was in my 30s, I said, okay, I'm going to be Judith now. And everybody has to call me Judith. And so all my family and all my friends, they all adjusted and they all started calling me Judith. And then when I was in Quebec and I was initiated into Sufi order, I got a Sufi name, Munira, which means the one who brings the light. And this is supposed to be a practice. So when somebody calls you that, you remember, I'm supposed to be the one who brings the light. But this time I wasn't quite so hardcore. I kind of kept the name Judith too. And like on my books, I put both Munira Judith. And some people called me Munira and some people called me Judith. And I was, you know, I was pretty relaxed about that. And then when I moved back to the U.S. in 2020, and I started meditating online, because it was a pandemic then, with Seattle Insight, everybody called me Judith because it was the name in my Zoom box. And, you know, it never even occurred to me to change it. And I finally realized it doesn't even matter. It's not the words. It's not the words. So other identities I've had, well, I was a wife. That was supposed to be for life. And then I was an ex-wife. I was a parent. I'm still a parent. But being the parent of people in their 50s, is really different from being the parent of toddlers or teenagers, right? And I've had the interesting experience of watching my children age, watching their hair turn gray, watching my grandson get taller than his father, you know? I was, for many years, 30 years, I was a technical writer and translator for a company in Montreal. And then I retired and poof, gone. Even my nationality. I was born in this country. I'm an American, right? But I'm also a Canadian. What does that mean? Does it mean anything? I don't know. So it's like all of these roles and identities have either changed or disappeared, and they all will disappear. That is inevitable. And even though I do not consider myself to be enlightened, I have to say I do hold these identities much more lightly. And when I look at that and I see how that constructed a self around all of that, I begin to hold that more lightly. And I think that's basically the way I'm practicing with this right now. So some wise person, I don't remember who, said, time is just an agreement that we make with each other. And I'm thinking maybe the self is too, you know, we have to have some sense of self to navigate this world. So, okay, I'll be the parent, you be the child. I'll be the teacher today, you be the students, and, or maybe I'll be the student, you be the teacher. Who knows, you know? So even though we need these identities to navigate the world, we also need to understand the ephemeral, the impermanent nature of this self that we have constructed and how pointless it is to cling to it. And I can say I am beginning to see this, and the older I get, the more I see it, right? So Ram Dass, any of you know who Ram Dass was? Yeah. My generation, just died a few years ago, he said, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody, right? You have to have a sense of self, a strong sense of self, before you can begin to let go of it. And I would say that's true. You have to be somebody before you can be nobody. But after you become nobody, you have to at least pretend you're somebody. So you can navigate through life, even though you know that actually you're nobody. Or maybe, you know, thinking of Thich Nhat Hanh and interbeing, maybe what you're actually is everybody.